Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with David Skeel of the University of Pennsylvania Law School on what a GM bankruptcy might look like. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Kim Phillips-Fine, author of a new book on the business conservatives' reaction against the New Deal, a movement that began in 1933 and reached its triumph with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, a 50-year-long march through the institutions. First, some words in the economic news. Again, more signs that the rate of decline is slowing, though hardly yet turning around. On Thursday morning, we learned that new orders for manufactured goods rose almost 2% in February, the first increase in 6 months. Orders for what is known as non-defense capital goods ex-aircraft, meaning the sort of gadgetry that is at the core of business investment and a key to long-term economic growth, rose by over 7%, a very strong performance for a month. Obviously, 1 month's positive numbers can easily turn into next month's negatives, but this is encouraging news, for now. New car sales even bounced a bit in March, thanks to big incentives, but they remain at very low levels. Still, this is a surprise. Yes, we need an economy that's not so dependent on the sales of new earth-destroying machines, but until we get there, this is what people's livelihoods depend on. In less good news, first-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 12,000 last week, and the average for the last 4 weeks rose by about half that much. About 650,000 people a week are now losing their jobs and signing up for unemployment insurance checks. The number of people continuing to draw benefits also rose last week to almost 6 million, nearly twice as much as a year ago. As a percentage of the population, both these measures are still below the highs of the mid-1970s and early 1980s, but they're still quite elevated and likely to go higher. Friday morning brought the release of the monthly employment report for March. Few signs of stabilization here. In fact, it was another stinker. Last month, 663,000 jobs disappeared. Almost half that loss was in goods production, construction, and manufacturing. But private services also got hammered, with almost every sector showing serious losses. Even government, usually reliable if modest gainer, lost jobs last month, mainly because of declines in local government employment. Since the economy peaked in December 2007, we've lost over 5 million jobs, with more almost certainly on the way. Those figures came from the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of about 300,000 employers. Their simultaneous survey of about 60,000 households showed that the unemployment rate jumped 0.4 of a point to 8.5%, the highest since 1983. Though not at the post-depression record yet, that would be 1982's 10.8%, it's still very high by post-World War II standards. And the share of the adult population working, the so-called employment population ratio, fell by 0.4 of a point to 59.9%, the lowest it's been since 1985. Since its cyclical peak, set in December 2006, a full year before the broad economy peaked, the employment pop ratio is off 3.5 points, the worst decline over any similar period since the series began 60 years ago. The ratio's rise was very weak during the expansion, and its steep decline over the last 27 months suggests that what used to be called the Great American Jobs Machine is now sputtering badly. The forward-looking measures in this report, like temp employment, which was down hard, and the length of the work week, which fell to a record low, suggest more of the same to come. In somewhat more comforting news, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which forecasts turns in the economy 3 to 6 months out, picked up a bit last week, its fourth consecutive rise. This suggests that maybe the abstraction known as the economy is stabilizing, but the job market, which is what matters to most people, has yet to get the news. And an update in the rogues gallery of malefactors in high places. A former quantitative analyst employed by the Harvard University Endowment says she was fired for questioning the university's investment strategies. Iris Mack, only the second African-American woman to get a Ph.D. in applied math, says that she was scandalized by the reckless use of derivatives that the endowment's traders didn't understand. According to her account, published in the university newspaper The Harvard Crimson, her colleagues didn't get basic financial math. She wrote the university's then-president, Larry Summers, to complain, and she was fired for making what were called baseless allegations. Funnily enough, her employer before Harvard was Enron, so the woman obviously knows fuzzy math from the inside. When Summers was president of Harvard, he pressed the university to borrow heavily to take aggressive investment positions that have since turned very sour, forcing the university to borrow to meet basic operating expenses. Need I point out that Summers is now running the economy? Finally, in other news, one Edward Hattis, writing on the financial news site BreakingViews.com, complains about the lack of a serious left opposition. His opening words, inspired by the anti-G20 demos in London the other day, "A great age of protest should be dawning. The global mismanagement of the financial system has led to a deep recession. Intellectual paralysis has gripped the authorities and their policy response has been risky. After such failure, the political leaders gathered in London for the G20 conference deserve serious challenge. Sadly, all they are getting are the senseless slogans of a hippie festival." That's the end of the quote from Hattis. Sad to say, he's got a point. The old Seattle strategy of street parties and puppets and all that seemed right for the late stages of the 1990s boom, but in the middle of this bust, they seem silly and irrelevant. As Hattis says, the world needs, quote, "a new intellectual framework, not a street party." He concludes, "Sadly, the more intellectually sophisticated left seems hardly more capable of helping out. Any protester who can articulate a coherent alternative to the establishment's tattered notions really could change the world." That's the end of the quote. It's true, and I'm hanging my head in shame that I haven't done more to articulate that alternative. I'll try harder in the future. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about going bust. Was some of Beethoven's Bagatelle, Opus 126, Number 4, performed by Alfred Brendel. My first guest today is David Skeel of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, who is much in media demand these days because his specialty is bankruptcy. Behind the News was lucky to have scored 20 minutes with him to talk mostly about GM, with some parenthetical remarks about the Lehman Brothers collapse. GM. Bankruptcy. It's amazing to think about this iconic corporation at death's door. Its chair in the 1950s, Charlie Wilson, famously declared that what is good for America is good for General Motors, and vice versa. Does that mean that the crisis at GM is some sort of crisis for America? It looks that way. But that's a bigger question than what David Skeel addresses in this interview. We'll ponder that one in the coming weeks. David Skeel. Welcome, David Skeel. So, of course, bankruptcy much in the news these days. GM, it looks like the administration is looking to force GM into bankruptcy. What might that look like? What would the process involve? What would the end product be?
Well, the administration's hope is that what it looks like is just what they call a quick rinse, that everything, all the ducks are in a row by the time the filing comes, and then they just use bankruptcy to do some things they can't do outside of bankruptcy, restructure GM and get them out in a few months. The downside risk is that it'll be more than a few months. Once you get into bankruptcy, you lose a lot of control, and as we've seen in lots of other cases, sometimes that means staying in bankruptcy for a long time. So from a big picture perspective, what they want is a short bankruptcy. What they're afraid of is a chaotic bankruptcy. What bankruptcy would mean is it generally means business as usual. So it's not like the business would shut down or they would stop making cars, but it does mean that creditors have to stop collecting trying to collect what they're owed, it also gives some powers that would not be present outside of bankruptcy. One power is the power to write down bonds by a majority vote of the bondholders, which you can't do outside of bankruptcy. That's a big issue in GM right now. Another one, which is obviously hugely important, is that it's easier to redo collective bargaining agreements in bankruptcy.
The administration, I guess, wants people, most of the principal parties, to be pretty much in agreement before this thing enters the official bankruptcy phase. But they've got, what, thousands, millions of bondholders? What are the chances of getting some kind of unity of opinion among such a diverse crowd?
I think they're very low. And certainly, if you look at GM and you look at all the bondholders, you look at the difficulties with the employees, GM is not the classic case for a quick bankruptcy. The quickest bankruptcy is what is known as a pre-pack. It's definitely not a good candidate for a pre-pack. Those pre-packs are cases that are resolved very quickly because the only problem is there's a little bit too much debt. Obviously, GM has a lot more in the way of problems than that. There's also what's known as a pre-negotiated bankruptcy. That's what the administration is thinking about, which is one where you line most everybody up before you file for bankruptcy. But even there, GM is such a complicated company with very complicated problems. It's really, really optimistic to think that this is going to be a 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 month bankruptcy. Historically, with a company like GM, it's been more likely to be a 2-year or a 3-year bankruptcy.
Well, who are some of the interest groups? Of course, we mentioned the bondholders, but dealers, workers, suppliers, are they all involved in this?
They absolutely are, and each of them has a particular stake. With dealers, GM has a lot more power to terminate bad dealerships inside of bankruptcy than outside of bankruptcy. Outside of bankruptcy, if GM shuts down some of its dealerships, GM has to pay for that. Inside of bankruptcy, what happens if GM shuts down dealerships is those dealerships have a claim in the bankruptcy case, and what that ends up meaning is the dealerships get what we call bankruptcy dollars, which is 10 cents on the dollar rather than 100 cents on the dollar. You get the payout in the bankruptcy case. So dealerships are one interest. Another really big interest is the suppliers of GM. One of the big concerns that has been raised is if GM files for bankruptcy and that means that its suppliers don't get paid, at least for a period of time, many of the suppliers, which at least the ones that aren't already in bankruptcy, will end up in bankruptcy and there'll be all kinds of ripple effects. Now, I think that concern is a little bit overstated because suppliers generally do end up mostly getting paid in bankruptcy, but that's another interest group and another set of issues, and I'm sure you could go from there. GM is an extraordinarily complicated company, and there are many, many different groups that have an interest in it.
How would the workers and the retirees stand up in the pecking order?
They're not in a great position, and this is one of the things that makes this such a complicated and difficult case. With respect to retiree benefits, they can be altered in bankruptcy, and there's a good chance that if there's a bankruptcy, retirees are going to lose a lot of what they have now, and particularly things like their health care benefits. Obviously, that's something that the Obama administration is well aware of, but it is just a huge issue in this case because there are tens of thousands of retirees out there.
And so who holds the upper hand in the proceedings like this? Who is really the top dog?
Well, ordinarily, the upper hand would be held to some extent by the debtor. Alternatively, it might be held by the debtor's lender, depending on what the lending arrangement looked like going into bankruptcy. So in the old days, it usually was the debtor that held the upper hand. In the last 10 or 15 years, the banks that lent money to a debtor in bankruptcy have been pretty strict about the terms of those loans, and they've used those loans to control the case. In this case, what that would mean is the government, to the extent the government is the lender, potentially holds a lot of the levers, and I think they are the main source of power. And the principal counter to the leverage the government will have is the threat of what will happen if the government pulls the plug. There's really a game of chicken here. The government can say, we're going to pull the plug unless bondholders, you get in line, union and GM, you reach deals, and that's a very powerful threat. But on the other hand, GM and the unions have the ability to say, you can't afford to pull the plug on us because it's going to destroy the lives of thousands of people. There are going to be ripple effects that go all the way through the economy. So this is a very strange case in many respects. And one is this one, that the government holds a really big lever, but it's a dangerous lever to pull.
Now, what about the bondholders? If things just take their natural course, they could end up with 10 cents on the dollar. Is the hope they might get 20 or 30?
It's possible they'll get a bit more than that. I haven't looked at the financials very closely, but in many cases this big, bondholders will get more than 10 cents on the dollar, but they're not going to get a dollar for what they're owed. It'll be somewhere in between. My guess would be that it would be in the 20 to 40 or 50 cents range. I think in Enron that was roughly what bondholders got. So it's hard to tell, and obviously that's something that they are they're trying to figure out now. With respect to bondholders, the amount of leverage they have is radically different outside of bankruptcy and inside of bankruptcy. Outside of bankruptcy, they have quite a bit of leverage because no bondholder can be forced to take less than 100 cents on the dollar unless they agree to it. There's a 1939 law that says each bondholder gets to make that decision for herself. Inside of bankruptcy, there are voting rules, and if what turns out to be two-thirds of the value of the bonds vote in favor of a restructuring, everybody's stuck with that restructuring. So in some respects, the bondholders would probably much rather stay outside of bankruptcy. They have a lot more leverage before GM goes in.
Among the bondholders, I imagine there are divisions between, say, long-term institutional investors who've held these bonds for a long time versus speculators who've moved in hoping they can make a quick buck, that the bonds are trading below whatever value they'll emerge out of this process. How important are those divisions for this process?
They're fairly important divisions. And in fact, some leading bankruptcy lawyers, and I'm thinking here of Harvey Miller, who's GM has retained him. He's the bankruptcy lawyer in the Lehman Brothers case. He argues that the trading of debt, which is how those vulture funds get in, they buy the debt of a company that's in trouble, either right before or during bankruptcy, has completely changed the bankruptcy process, and that the vulture investors have no stake in no long-term stake of any sort in the company, and they're willing to play chicken even if it will destroy value. Long-term investors, on the other hand, are much less likely to push for immediate draconian measures, and so their incentives look quite different. So bottom line is the mix of different bondholders in particular, but creditors in general, does have a very strong impact on the case, and it could add to the confusion of the case because creditors, even within one group of bonds, don't have the same perspectives.
What's your guess that's going to happen? How's this going to shake out?
This is such a hard thing to figure out. It certainly appears to be the case that the Obama administration is at this point willing to bite the bullet, but I also think that they know the political ramifications of all of this. They're not going to force GM into bankruptcy, I don't think, and allow the employees to be completely sold down the river. So,
this is a negotiating ploy, then?
It's just so hard to tell. I kind of think it is, but I'm not sure that it is, just because there are several key things that you can do in bankruptcy that you can't do outside of bankruptcy. And the treatment of the bondholders is maybe the most important at this point. So I think one way to answer the question would be to say, if it looks like they're not going to line up, if it looks like the vast majority of them can't be persuaded to accept a deal outside of bankruptcy, I think that the administration might be forced to push GM into bankruptcy. So I think until now it has been a negotiating ploy, but I'm not sure it is at this point. And truth be told, I suspect the administration doesn't know if they'll pull the plug. They, I suspect, are praying that there's a way to work this out without going into bankruptcy. Bankruptcy just dramatically ratchets up the uncertainty, but it's just not clear that there is an alternative at this point. So that was a law professor's way to answer your question without really answering it. But just sort of bottom line, two weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I would have said, and I have said, there's no way the administration at the end of the day will let GM file for bankruptcy. But I'm not so sure about that. You can read what's going on now as the administration trying to prepare us for the bankruptcy.
What is the effect, if any, of having a private equity guy, Steve Rattner, running this show rather than a car guy or a political figure or something like that?
This is a great question, and I think you have to imagine as a first cut that it means that, well, that you're going to get a little bit less sympathy for GM and for its employees, and you'll get a little bit more of a Wall Street kind of perspective. But Rattner knows bankruptcy, and he knows what the political score is, and so I suspect the perspective he will bring will be more of a financial perspective and not quite as much of an automotive industry perspective. But there are other people who are involved in this decision-making process who are coming from a very different place, starting with the president.
And let's look back a little bit, just the last few minutes of this. What about the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy? What do you think of the way that was handled?
Well, I have a very contrarian view of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. The standard line on the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy is it was a complete catastrophe, and it shows that you can't use bankruptcy to resolve the financial distress of big financial institutions. And my view is that is exactly the wrong message. My view was that the big mistake that was made was bailing out Bear Stearns back a year ago in March of 2008, and Bear Stearns should have been allowed to file for bankruptcy, and if they had, I think things would have played out a little bit differently. But what the government did was they sent a signal with Bear Stearns that any big investment bank that runs into trouble, we are going to help out. There's going to be government money backing the resolution. When we got to Lehman Brothers crisis weekend last September, both Lehman and its buyers thought there was going to be government money to support that sale, and the government pulled the plug at the last second. So my view of Lehman Brothers is that the government essentially dumped Lehman Brothers into bankruptcy. If they had either followed through on the implicit promise to bail them out, it would have been a little bit better. Or if the government had never gone down this road of suggesting they were going to bail everybody out, I think it would have been better. So what we got was a third alternative that was worse than either of the other two. Since Lehman Brothers has been in bankruptcy, since the filing, the bankruptcy process has actually handled it really well. It was a mess when they defaulted. But the human capital assets, the investment banking business, was dealt with in less than a week. It was sold to Barclays 4 or 5 days later. And what is going on now is the rest of Lehman Brothers' assets are being assessed and unwound and being resolved in an orderly fashion. So my view is that the conventional wisdom on Lehman is almost completely wrong.
Is GM a more complicated case than Lehman?
Well, it's more complicated in some case, and in some ways, and less complicated in others. In terms of the number of constituencies involved, it's a much more complicated case than Lehman. It is, in some respects, simpler because simpler in one respect, and that is that with Lehman Brothers, the fear was that the negative effects of a Lehman Brothers bankruptcy would be felt instantly. The issue was timing and how quickly all of this gets resolved. That's not quite as much of an issue with General Motors. General Motors, in many respects, looks like the kinds of companies that we have reorganized through bankruptcy-like procedures for the last 100 years. It looks like the railroads in the 19th century, which were what led to our first corporate reorganization approach or resolution proceeding or corporate reorganization proceeding. It looks like, in some respects, the airlines or some of the companies that failed after the LBOs of the 1980s. So in some respects, it's a more classic bankruptcy case. And in some respects, it's simpler than Lehman because we don't have this worry that there's going to be this instant catastrophic effect on the markets. But in other respects, it's much more complicated because the ripple effects are more difficult to determine. We have the question of tens of thousands of employees of GM and how they'll be affected, the question of how the employees of the suppliers of GM will be affected, how the American economy will be affected. So in some of those respects, it is a much more complicated case.
But I guess the scale of this is just really unprecedented, isn't it?
It is. It is, I think, would be the short answer. The longer answer would be technically it's not the biggest case ever. Lehman Brothers was a $600 billion case, at least in theory, whereas the numbers I've seen for GM are that it's worth $110 billion, $120 billion, somewhere in there. But nobody really believes Lehman Brothers was worth $600 billion the day before it filed for bankruptcy. And I think in reality, although there have been a small number of cases on the same order of magnitude as GM, no case has all of the things it has. The size of the case, the complexity of the case, the role that the auto industry plays in America's sense of itself. It is, in some respects, the most complicated case you can imagine. And in a sense, if they filed for bankruptcy, it would be the bankruptcy of an idea of what America is and what America's relationship to its workers is.
And finally, you did allude to this a few minutes ago, but there's a tendency to think that all this stuff is just without any kind of historical precedent. But in fact, the American economy has been here many, many times before, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. As I alluded to a couple of minutes ago, our first corporate reorganization procedures, which turned out to look a lot like what Chapter 11 now looks like, were forged in the crucible of the great economic depressions of the 19th century, and in particular, the way those depressions affected railroads. And we've seen that cycle all the way through history. The railroads were the story in the 19th century, in the 20th century. In the Great Depression, there were a wide variety of other companies that used our bankruptcy procedures. And the remarkable thing about them is how successful they've been. The world is unimaginably different than what it looked like in the late 19th century, and yet this procedure that was created in the late 19th century, created by courts, not by Congress, has proven adaptable to the American economy as it's changed. And although this is a terrible, terrible time, I think that the bankruptcy will, in the next year or two, play a role in helping us to start over again in the same way as it has for over a century.
Busy times for a bankruptcy expert these days, huh?
It certainly is. It was very, very quiet a few weeks ago, and it is not quiet any longer.
All right, well, thanks for taking the time, David Skeel.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to talk to you again.
That was David Skeel, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about business conservatism and the New Deal. Thank you. And that was some of Beethoven's Bagatelle, Opus 126, Number 4, performed by Alfred Brendel. And now we're joined in the studio by Kim Phillips-Fine, who teaches in the Gallatin program at NYU and is the author of the book Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. And that was published recently by W.W. Norton. Welcome, Kim.
Hi, Doc. Thanks a lot for having me on.
The cliched interpretation of the New Deal is that the business sector and the right was in extreme disarray, deeply on the defensive. But there are actually secret cabals resisting the dominance of what they perceived as socialism going on, weren't there?
Yes. During the 30s, there was an intense reaction on the part of many business people against the New Deal. Well, businessmen, really. Almost everybody who I write about in the book is male. And there was fierce hostility during the 30s to the program of reform that FDR was pushing for, and that FDR was pushed to create by the mass movements of the time.
Well, who at first? I mean, the DuPonts were very central to the early resistance to the New Deal. Tell us about them and their role.
Well, there's a variety of different kinds of business organizing during the 30s against the New Deal. And yeah, the DuPonts were central. The DuPonts actually had initially supported Roosevelt, you know, against Herbert Hoover, at least the eldest brother did. There was a sense, you know, at the time that the Depression was just completely wiping out the business class, not just in terms of profits and economic problems, but also it was kind of a threat to their political credibility in a deep way because they had been so exalted and celebrated during the 20s. And I think there's people like Pierre DuPont, the oldest of the three DuPont brothers, felt that there needed to be some kind of change. You couldn't simply support Herbert Hoover again. He also was kind of opposed to prohibition.
Do they understand there was really a serious problem with their model, or they're just hoping to restore the status quo ante?
Well, I think in 1932, there's just a sense of total desperation they want to bring things back. They don't really see a fundamental problem with their model. I mean, and we can see that because very quickly, once Roosevelt is in office, as strikes start to spread and deepen, and as it seems like the federal government isn't going to be totally opposed to these in the way that it had been earlier, we see the DuPonts starting to organize against the New Deal. And what they did is they formed the American Liberty League, which was an organization that was primarily a paper organization. I mean, it really produced pamphlets. It kind of sponsored people giving speeches. But what was interesting about it is that it claimed to be a kind of mass organization. They said that they were trying to build a mass movement against the New Deal and that they were open to anybody, to people from all walks of life, housewives, workers, farmers. And they kind of claimed to have this sort of mass support and base. In reality, the organization was really very tightly controlled by the DuPonts and by a small number of other business executives who they did outreach to and who they fundraised from. But they knew that the New Deal and that the crisis demanded that they claim to have a deeper popular basis than they had previously felt the need to demonstrate in this kind of political way.
So was there anything like what we'd call a petty bourgeois mass base for them, some kind of small business or new money? I mean, they were the very picture of old money, big business. Was there anything they could pretend would provide some kind of populist cover for their elite agitation?
Well, they claimed to have a membership, but they didn't. They didn't ever kind of do mass demonstrations, or they didn't ever try to mobilize these people in a public way. And so we don't really know that much about who actually the members of the organization were. And their rhetoric was very kind of high principle. I mean, they didn't say we are the small shopkeepers speaking up. You know, they didn't kind of present themselves as a small business organization. They presented themselves as this high ideological rhetoric about assaults on the Constitution and the like.
This was FDR's first term that this was happening, right?
Yeah, it started during his first term.
And then when his second term rolled around, he had a little more political trouble after the court packing thing, mm-hmm. and the failure of the NRA and all this business. So how did things change in the second Roosevelt term? Did business have a little easier time of it?
During the second Roosevelt term, we also see, you know, the sit-down strikes, and we see businesses being forced to recognize unions. So I think, I mean, in some ways, in the late 30s, the Liberty League kind of goes under the National Association of Manufacturers, which also kind of has a big drive during this period. I think in a lot of ways, even though FDR is having these political setbacks and the New Deal is kind of not making any further progress, that's not just because of the resistance of business, and it's a kind of broader crisis that the program was facing at the time.
Were there any business allies for the New Deal? The business class wasn't entirely opposed, was it?
Yeah, no, there are definitely business allies for the New Deal as well. People like Swope of General Electric work with Roosevelt, help develop the NRA. I think that the two parts of the New Deal, the first part, the National Recovery Administration, has a lot more support from business than the Wagner Act and even Social Security.
That was legalized price fixing. They could enjoy
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Right?
They were perfectly happy with that. And I think, you know, when we shouldn't see the New Deal. I mean, the New Deal kind of contained a lot of different political tendencies. It's by no means – I mean, Roosevelt himself was obviously never an anti-capitalist and always was surprised in a lot of ways by the hostility that some of his programs, you know, met with from business people.
Yeah, that's – I always wondered about that. Even, you know, crusty old – right-wingers today, you know, just they still hate Roosevelt for mm-hmm. as a traitor to his class and all that. He really saved them.
Yeah.
And he saved the system. And he was certainly not hostile to private capital. You know, he was an aristocrat himself. He's certainly not some kind of, you know, radical Bolshevik. What were these business people thinking? What was it that motivated them in this fury against the New Deal?
Well, I wondered about that a lot while working on the book, and I think that there's something.
And you spent a lot of time reading their papers and their letters.
A lot of reading their papers and letters and, you know, publications and
as close as you can get to getting inside their heads.
Yeah, one of the sort of frightening things about the book is the extreme sensitivity that this group of people has to almost anything that challenges their power and prerogatives on any level. And in some ways, the long view that that the Wagner Act, or, you know, or by legalizing unions, you kind of incorporate people into the system in some way, or that Social Security or social welfare reforms, that these things have the effect, let alone the kind of full employment or deficit spending that ultimately was able to end the Depression, although not during the 30s, but only with World War II, the sense that these things might actually be good for capitalism and good for business in the long run. They really are sort of allergic to that idea, and I think it is because they perceive them as a sort of assault on their power and their ability to know what's best for society as a whole. That even the most banal Keynesian welfare stimulus spending program, it suggests that the state and not private individual capitalists has to step in and has to play a role. And they resent that. They resent that sense that they aren't, you know, that the market left to itself and private enterprise left to itself doesn't actually have the best interests of everybody at heart.
There are also personal inconveniences that you quote a heartrending letter from one of the DuPonts saying that he lost some of his black servants to New Deal work schemes, right? So there's a very personal basis to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think they, you know, the workers at their own companies are organizing, and the ways in which the programs of the New Deal did empower workers and empower, you know, the people who serve as their servants, they resent that and were frustrated by it.
Now to shift gears a little bit, I was impressed throughout the book by how often so many of these business guys who are not intellectuals in themselves saw the need to have some kind of intellectual armor or weaponry. And so they funded intellectuals. They're very concerned about having conferences and books to promote their point of view. And even sort of cagely creating some distance between the movement and their own pecuniary self-interest, right?
Yeah, I think that's another very striking thing that I was sort of surprised by while doing the research for this is how committed these businessmen were to an intellectual program. For example, Jasper Crane, who was a DuPont executive, he was retired, you know, by the time he started doing this work, but he was very deeply involved with Friedrich Hayek and the Mont Pelerin Society. And the Mont Pelerin Society, yeah, it's not, you know, it's not a kind of out there, you know, it's not even a policymaking organization. It's just a conference of academics and intellectuals who gather and discuss the market and promoting the market. And we can talk about more about what it did in a minute if you want to. But I think this gives you a sense of kind of the magnitude of the Depression, I think, and what these people felt they were facing. It wasn't enough to just go back. I mean, but in the 30s, perhaps, when the struggle is still going on, it might at that point be enough to kind of try to rehabilitate the old order and to rehabilitate laissez-faire. But by the end of World War II, there is a sense that their program has truly failed, and they haven't been able to win any political support for it on any level, and that a new order has come into existence, and that if they want to bring the market and bring capitalism back and kind of remove the stain of depression and war from capitalism, they'll need to start afresh, and they'll need to start again by funding a new group, by creating a new intellectual justification for our social order.
I was impressed. Richard Hofstadter said something somewhere. I can't remember where exactly, but he characterized the New Deal, the long New Deal period, from the 30s into the 60s, as the only instance in American economic and social history when there was a sort of sense of collectivity and a sense that the state had a big role in the economy. And that was a major departure from American practice. And in some sense, we've restored that old order, at least until very recently. But these guys were very aware that something fundamental had shifted and they were on the wrong side of it.
Yeah, they felt that there had been a deep, basic change in American institutions, that now you had this large federal government, you had labor unions. You know, at the end of World War II, it was not going to be possible to beat back unions as had happened at the end of World War I. And they had a sense that this was a new, that people had a new set of expectations as well from the government. And I think that, they felt that something very profound had changed.
And let's talk a little bit more about Hayek and von Mises and the Mont Pelerin crowd. They were a real departure from classic conservatism. They didn't see themselves they saw themselves as revolutionaries of a sort or radicals of a sort. They weren't the kind of polite, backward-looking gang that associate with traditional conservatism, right? These guys were real troublemakers.
Yeah, they saw themselves as instigators, and they saw themselves as kind of pushing. Hayek writes an essay in 1960 called Why I Am Not a Conservative, in which he argues that he has nothing to do with traditional conservatives, that they want to kind of just restore the past. They want to kind of protect order. And he, on the other hand, stands for kind of freedom, transformation, and a trust, a kind of openness and trust to the forces of the market. And I think what's...
It was not – the market for him was not about efficiency.
Yeah, it's not about –
It was almost
a
moral principle, right?
Right. It's really not about it's not about economic efficiency. It's not about growth or material well-being. On a fundamental level, it really has to do with freedom for him, or some idea of freedom. It's not about restoring social order, but about opening things up and this kind of liberation almost.
What was the founding moment of the Mont Pelerin Society?
Well, they gathered in Switzerland on the Mont Pelerin, for which it's the organization is named. They had a big argument about what to call the organization, and actually Hayek originally wanted to call it the Acton Tocqueville Society after two conservative philosophers. He was convinced that this was not the way to go, and instead they settled on the Mont Pelerin Society. And at this founding meeting, Hayek and a group of most of the people there were European academics and economists, people who had survived World War II and were kind of gathering. And there was a sense that they were meeting to engage in what Hayek called a wild experiment, and this real sort of sense of self-importance about what they were doing, formulating a new intellectual program that would rescue classical liberalism from the disdain into which it had fallen.
And liberalism, that's an
liberalism,
important word.
Yeah.
It's confusing to American audiences that liberalism is not what we think of as liberalism.
Yeah, this is the kind of the liberalism of the 19th century of free trade and
limited government.
Yeah, free trade and limited government.
The night watchman state and all
yeah.
that. And when were they founded? What year?
46?
So this was that's when those sorts of ideas were in extreme disfavor.
Yeah.
And then Hayek wrote the – when did he write The Road to Serfdom? When did that appear?
That's in 1944. So that that precedes the Mont Pelerin Society. That kind of launched Hayek into public view.
But then it was kind of a surprise hit as a book, wasn't it?
Yeah, no one expected. I mean, The Road to Serfdom was rejected by publishers, and it took a long time to convince the University of Chicago Press to publish it. They thought it would sell a couple thousand copies. Instead, it has sold hundreds of thousands of copies and is, assigned in undergraduate classes across the country. And The Road to Serfdom is this kind of short book, really a tract kind of explaining why any kind of social democratic or liberal or kind of Rooseveltian New Deal liberal program will ultimately end in fascism and totalitarianism. And that there's no kind of that it doesn't depend upon.
They were the National Socialists, after all.
Yeah,
right?
They were the National Socialists. Hayek loved to say that. And there's no need. I mean, these people are a little bit different from McCarthy or anti-communist intellectuals. They weren't worried about war with the Soviet Union. They weren't worried about espionage. They believe that the inner logic of liberalism would inevitably end in totalitarianism, whether or not the liberal reformers themselves were aware of what they were doing. That was the logic of their actions.
And I'm guessing these guys were pretty snobbish and wouldn't have felt comfortable with Joe the Plumber.
No, they were not interested in Joe the Plumber. They were it's a membership. You have to be invited to join the Mont Pelerin Society. You can't, it's not open to anybody. I mean, in this way, it's actually even different from the idea of the Liberty League, which, you know, did have this kind of sense of wanting to build a mass populist movement. These people are kind of the opposite. They see themselves as engaged in this kind of elite intellectual project. And what's interesting is their business funders felt that way too. They actually didn't even want their kind of business backers to join at first. Hayek was aware that this would be perceived as, you know, kind of self-interested and overly materialistic. And so at first they weren't really even allowed to become members. They changed their policy on that over time, but they wanted only the finest minds to participate.
I am speaking with Kim Phillips Fine, author of the book Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. And it is a very, very fine book, I have to say. I wanted to before we get to more recent times, just remind folks that the right wing was very disturbed by Dwight David Eisenhower back in the 1950s. He had made peace with some of the New Deal, at least, and made peace with unions. And I recall, speaking of Hofstadter, as I did earlier, he quotes some right-wing nut who would probably have a show on Fox now if she was were alive today. But she said on Eisenhower's reelection, 4 more years of socialism. And the hard right really thought that of Eisenhower, didn't they?
Yeah, they thought that Eisenhower was – I mean, the really hard right thought that Eisenhower might be in league with the Soviet Union in one way or another. But even the people who didn't believe in that kind of conspiracy saw Eisenhower as just extending the principles of the New Deal. You know, Eisenhower didn't do anything to shrink the federal government. He expanded Social Security. The minimum wage went up. He didn't take a hard anti-union position. On the contrary, there was a book A Modern Republican Looks at His Party, which was written by kind of a minor official in the Eisenhower administration, Arthur Larson, which articulated a new vision for Republicans in the 20th century, was how he put it. And he said, you know, we have to accept the New Deal. We have to accept unions. We have to accept this new kind of responsibilities of the state. So it's that kind of position that the business right is responding to during the 50s.
But since Ike was the top of the Republican Party, the government was not friendly to them, so they were still pretty marginalized.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they definitely, in terms of the political parties, they didn't really have a place. I mean, they build over the course of the 50s and early 60s a place for themselves within the Republican Party under the leadership ultimately of Barry Goldwater, who very much comes out of this world of business conservatives. So these are people who are not represented in the political parties. At the same time, they're not exactly marginal people. I mean, they're people who own factories, people who have access to money and social resources in their communities. They aren't ever, you know, really on the fringes of society or the dispossessed or something.
They're not like the Spartacist League.
They're not like the Spartacist League. They're the country club crowd. I mean, they're people who are well-respected and have lots of cash and who are just seen as, you know, there's nothing about them that – I think this is something, I mean, a lot of kind of writing about the right in the 50s makes it seem as though, you know, the far right in the 50s or the business – the kind of people who object to Eisenhower are all, you know, totally nuts. And there are some people like that. That is true. But but there's a much larger group of people who are, you know, the pillars of their communities but who also think that Eisenhower is – taking the nation towards socialism.
Oh, now let's talk a bit about a very fateful hire. General Electric hired Ronald Reagan in 1954 to advance the cause of business conservatism. So tell us about the Reagan's career as a spokesperson for GE.
Well, Reagan was hired initially to both host the GE television program. There was a weekly hour-long drama program that Reagan hosted. And also, as part of his contract, he was expected to go around the country speaking to people at GE's 130-odd plants in many different states. And I think what people don't recognize about Reagan's time at GE often is that GE during that period was one of the most politicized companies in the United States. The company had a very extensive a lengthy strike in 1946, and which the company had basically lost. It had to give in to the demands of the union, and after that, the management set about a program of kind of self-consciously finding ways to undermine the union at GE. And to do this, they hired this fellow named Lemuel Ricketts Bulwer. And Bulwer really saw GE as engaged in this broad political battle. It wasn't just a management labor battle at one company. GE was really kind of standing strong against the forces of socialism in the United States at large, as embodied by labor unions. And he both kind of had this very hardline contract bargaining strategy, in which was the idea was to never make it appear as though the union was able to win anything for the workers, to always kind of put out an offer and say that it was a final offer, no bargaining. They might take a few recommendations from the union, but there was no real bargaining because the company had access to the wisdom of the market. And if the company put it out there, it was acting in the balanced best interests of all. There was nothing the union could do about it. He also, at the same time, had a very vigorous propaganda campaign. GE was kind of blanketed in newspapers, magazines, books, conservative books that Bulwer kind of wanted his management, supervisory staff, and even workers to read. He encouraged all supervisors to read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. He encouraged everyone to get the National Review after the magazine was founded in 1955. He kind of just books like The Road Ahead, which was a kind of anti-New Deal tract by John Flynn. He wanted supervisors to go out and set up discussion groups in their homes where they would talk about the literature that he provided. He even set up a class on free market economics on company time, which all of GE's workers were expected to attend. So the whole company is really awash in these conservative economic ideas during the 50s. And that's when Reagan comes there and starts speaking to GE's workforce. And I think that he was just in this milieu where talking about the free market and talking about the progressive tax as the brainchild of Marx and Engels and the talking about labor unions as kind of quasi-socialist organizations, that all of these things were just in the air at GE at the time, and they became part of Reagan's speeches over the time that he was at the company. And he would go and talk to workers and then go meet with Chamber of Commerce, the Kiwanis Club, the Rotary Club, these networks of people that he was kind of tapping into.
There's a tendency among liberals and leftists to think that Reagan was a numbskull, but this man had considerable talents, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, he had a lot of charisma, a lot of kind of ability to connect with people. You can read in this, you can see descriptions of him talking to these groups of workers, and he clearly had the ability to make people feel as though he was really, connecting with them in a sort of intimate way. And I think also it's not, a lot of the time the discussion of Reagan kind of, on the one hand, the right kind of people write these kind of hagiographies. On the left, people say Reagan was an idiot. And I think that one thing that kind of looking at Reagan's background and the community out of which his ideas were coming, I mean, he's not kind of inventing this stuff on his own. He's part of a whole world of people who are thinking and talking this way during the 50s and afterwards. And it's in this milieu and in this kind of, hothouse that he develops his political philosophy and vision. And he is a man. I mean, I think one thing you have to Reagan, he's never just kind of an idiot or pushed around by other people. He had a very clear, consistent, coherent political ideology. and he stuck with it for his whole life, really.
And he was a popularizer, but of
a clear set of ideas. I mean, when he says that he's drawing on, there's this, after he was elected, he gave a speech to the Conservative Political Action Conference where he talked about, Hayek and Mises, Milton Friedman, and I expect he read these people. I mean, he certainly read the kind of popular versions of their thought. And he's not, he's working within a real intellectual and political tradition.
Well, we're just about out of time for this segment, but I did want you to just comment on the present. Got an economic crisis is not the Great Depression yet, but orthodoxy is very much on the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense of confusion and humiliation among the business world and the financial world and their spokespersons. There is alarm on the right that mm-hmm. Barack Obama is taking us to socialism. And Barack Obama is no FDR, as far as mm-hmm. I can tell. But there are certain parallels to the 30s. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated time. There's been a lot of discussion lately about conservatism being dead. This cover article in the New Republic making that claim. I mean, I think on the one hand, Obama, received a lot of support from certain parts of the business community during his election campaign. His advisors, many of them come out of the financial world that is now in disarray. I think it's not – and I think there is a sense of crisis and just as there was in the early 30s, a sense that the old order kind of had these deep flaws. And, that business people, financiers are looking for someone who can kind of save them but do so in a way that doesn't fundamentally change the nature of the system. So, that's kind of one side of things. I mean, I think what's really striking to me is that in this moment of crisis, that there is as much kind of coherence, arrogance, and venality among these people as there is. I mean, for example, the AIG bonuses. Why on earth did they think they could get away with that? There's a level of self-confidence that still exists. And I think it may partly be because there isn't really a kind of challenge from the Obama administration in a profound way, that there isn't, or from anywhere else yet. And I think in some senses, even though there's a sense that the old order has failed, there isn't a sense that a new one is coming into existence. There are still attempts to kind of patch it up, still attempts to kind of restore it rather than moving away from it altogether. And I also think, I think if there is a kind of leftward move, if we did see the Employee Free Choice Act go anywhere, you already are seeing a lot of business organizing against that. I mean, even the same companies like Citibank, I think, hosting a conference call with the Chamber of Commerce, the same companies that are taking enormous amounts of public money are also at the same time, engaged in the same type of anti-labor organizing that has, that they've been doing for a long while. We'll have to see if there is a deeper challenge. I'm sure that there will be a kind of stronger backlash against it. I mean, I feel like that's one – my research anyway suggests that it is only under conditions of extreme crisis that American capitalists tolerate any level of restriction on their sort of freedom of action.
And even then they're not
– it's difficult. Then it's sort of partial, fractured, and there's a lot of divisions among them. So I think though at the same time, what that means for us is that it's necessary to find ways to kind of counter and challenge their power and not allow it to be the only thing out there.
All right. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Kim Phillips Fine, who is the author of Invisible Hands, The Making of a Conservative Movement from New Deal to Reagan, published by Norton. And it's a terrific book about a very important topic. And thank you, Kim. And,
thank you, Doug, for having
me
on.
May you sell many, many copies of this book.
Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the Sonata for Cello and Piano No. 3, Second Movement by Beethoven, performed by the father-son team of Alfred Brendel on the piano and Adrian Brendel on the cello. Till next week. Bye.